Elected in 2008, Congresswoman Jackie Speier has had quite a journey to the U.S. Capitol. 40 years ago, she was left for dead during the Jonestown massacre while she was serving as a congressional legal advisor. Faced with unthinkable trauma, she fought both for her life and for her place in Washington, D.C. In her new book, Undaunted, Surviving Jonestown, Summoning Courage and Fighting Back, she shares her story. It's a great pleasure to welcome Congresswoman Jackie Speier to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Joe.
Happy New Year to you. Very nice to have you on the program. This happened a long time ago when we speak of Jonestown. What was the motivation now to write about it and to tell the story?
This year is the 40th anniversary of that horrific tragedy in Jonestown in South America, in the country of Guyana. And while it happened to me 40 years ago, I have had 40 years of experience with lots of other lifetime traumas and challenges, and I thought it was a great time to hopefully create a message of resilience to those that read the book, whether you're young or old or male or female. That was my intent with this particular effort.
How much do you think over the course of time that simply whole new generations are coming up that we lose sight of what happened in Jonestown, and anniversaries give us an opportunity to be reminded of the horrific nature of that event?
It's very true. And, you know, this started out as a church like any other church. It was affiliated with the Disciples of Christ Church and grew up in Indianapolis, moved to Northern California, eventually to San Francisco. And Jim Jones kind of changed from a inspirational pastor to a megalomaniac. And he had much power in San Francisco because he had 2,000 members of the People's Temple who could, at a moment's notice, walk precincts or create a throng at a rally. And he was one who helped get then-Mayor George Moscone elected and helped him repel a recall. And so he was rewarded with the chairmanship of the Housing Authority. But along with that, when there became complaints about child abuse and sexual abuse within the church and physical abuse, the powers that be in the city, whether it was the political leadership or law enforcement, ignored it. And part of the message is that we can't allow that to happen. He then took his community to South America, to Jonestown, to get away from the bad press. And again, then our State Department ignored defectors who were leaving the People's Temple and were telling harrowing stories about white knight trials where people were asked to drink a specific Kool-Aid. And eventually, not only was that a trial, it turned out that that's what was used to kill some 900 people after we had visited, took members of the People's Temple who wanted to leave out, and while we were gunned down on the airstrip, they were all being forced to take their lives at the commune.
You were 28 years old when this happened. You are part of this delegation prior to that, and you write about this, but prior to that, when is the first time you heard, do you distinctly remember the first time you heard the name Jim Jones?
Well, the first time was really when a defector had written about it in the local paper, and then a newest article came out by Marshall Kilduff that was very critical of Jim Jones. Congressman Ryan at the time had constituents who had young adult children who had gotten involved with the People's Temple. It was seen as a new age opportunity for whites and blacks to live together in harmony. So there was great appeal to it on the surface. But of course, what was going on behind the scenes was quite malignant. And so the congressman decided that he wanted to go down and see for himself because the State Department was telling him everything was great. And he was the kind of legislator that thought that the best way to find out was to experience it himself. And so that's why he made the trip down there.
Did you have any idea, did he and the delegation have any idea of the danger they were walking into?
You know, I was the one responsible for listening to all the audio tapes of interviews that had been taken of former members of the People's Temple, and I was very nervous about the trip. I was about to buy a condominium in Virginia and made the purchase contingent on my surviving the trip to Jonestown. I put a note in my desk drawer to my parents that actually is in the book where I talk about how grateful I am for the life I had led. So I had premonitions about the trip. Congressman Ryan, you know, rightfully thought there was nothing to worry about. No congressman had been assassinated in the line of duty abroad before. So I went on the trip, and people ask, well, why did you do it? Because it was 1978. Very few women were in top leadership positions on congressional staff. And I thought if I didn't go, I would be setting back women's opportunities. So it was on that basis that I went.
You talk about that memorandum, the note that you wrote your mom and dad that you left in your Capitol Hill desk drawer. At the end of that, you say, I have no regrets. Love, Jackie. So the obvious talk show question is, when did you start to have regrets?
Well, you know, my heart sunk at the end of the evening after we had been interviewing members of the temple when Don Harris, the NBC reporter, came up to us with a note that had been slipped to him that had the names of two members of the People's Temple who wanted to get out. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, it's true. Everything that we've been told is true. People are being held here against their will. And I thought we were sitting on a powder keg at that point. And sure enough, as the next day dawned and we were trying to escort people out, there were more and more people that wanted to leave. And it became very tense and very problematic. And, of course, you know, being maniacal as Jim Jones was, he was not going to let anyone take him down. And so he forced everyone to drink the Kool-Aid, which was laced with cyanide. 900 people died. I think he was shot in the head, either self-inflicted wound or had ordered someone to do it. And all that life was lost. 300 of those people were children, just beginning their lives. And it's an incredible tragedy that could have been averted if local law enforcement in San Francisco and the political elites in San Francisco had responded, or if the State Department had responded. So two huge black eyes in that terrible tragedy.
You were shot 5 times at point-blank range, and your injuries were near fatal. What do you remember of those hours immediately after and how you were ultimately rescued and brought home?
So I, you know, looked down at my body after I had been shot and thought, oh, my God, this is it. I'm dying. I'm not going to live to a ripe old age. I'm not going to be able to get married and have kids. I thought it was over. And so I said the act of contrition and waited for the lights to go out. And when they didn't, my grandmother kind of flashed in front of me, and I thought, I'm not going to have her live through my funeral if I can avoid it. And I dragged my body. No one understands how I did it. To the plane. It wasn't going anywhere, but I didn't know that. And eventually was placed on the side of the airstrip on an anthill. But as I say, you don't sweat the small stuff when you're dying. But I was on that airstrip for 22 hours without medical attention, and it was a very sobering time. I realized that if I survived, I was going to make a commitment to never take another day for granted, and to dedicate my life to public service. So I was airlifted out eventually. There was a U.S. medevac plane waiting at the airstrip in Georgetown, Guyana, and I looked at this white, gleaming plane with the words United States of America inscribed on it, and thinking, oh, my God, I'm home. And it was like someone had wrapped me in the American flag. I never, ever say the Pledge of Allegiance or sing the national anthem that I don't take myself back to that moment, because we're very lucky to live in this country and have the rights and responsibilities that we have. So airlifted out, spent 2 months with multiple surgeries, and eventually got out of the hospital. And then I decided on the very last day that you could run for Congressman Ryan's office to take out papers and run. I wasn't really prepared to campaign, but it was a six-week campaign, and I was still recovering from my injuries, and I lost. And it was a great opportunity to look outside of myself and stop being a victim and to try and move on with life. So the book is about moving on with life when one trauma or tragedy after another happened to me, and I was able to recover.
So 30 years after the event, you get elected and you go to Congress. What was it? What does that time, the 30 years, allow you, do you think, and brought you to the office? Because obviously you had much more time to prepare for a run and to make a difference in the seat that you hold now.
So I had no intentions of ever coming back to Congress. I ended up running for local office and then was in the state legislature in California for 18 years and term limited out. And then, lost for lieutenant governor of California and was, working in the private sector when the congressman who had held the seat for almost 30 years decided not to run. And people, encouraged me to throw my hat in the ring. So 29 years, literally, from the first time I ran to the second time I ran, I walked onto the House floor, and I certainly had Congressman Ryan in the back of my mind. He was a mentor for me. He taught me how to question the status quo, how to look behind the statements that are made, and it has been the basis on which I have legislated from the time I got elected to the Board of Supervisors to the new Congress that's about to start.
So let's talk about that. You have the last photo in the book is of what you call an amazing group of Democratic congresswomen. That number has increased thanks to the last election in 2017, the year 2018, the year that we just passed. So give us a sense of what you hope from this group of incoming women, specifically incoming Democratic women, and what you can accomplish in the Congress.
So there's great optimism with the new class of members who got elected, 35 of whom are women, 34 of whom are Democratic women. And what's really inspiring about this number is 22 of them have never served in public office before. These are women who decided one day to just throw their hat in the ring because they had a message to convey, and they were very convincing. So I think we're going to see great vigor in this class and hopefully an opportunity to right a lot of wrongs and create greater equality in our government. One of the first things I hope to see pass is the Equal Rights Amendment, which, believe it or not, is not in our Constitution, which means that there is no prohibition against discrimination based on sex, which is astonishing when you think about it. And as a result, it has prevented many women from reaching the kind of equity they deserve in the workplace and in other settings as well.
Jackie Speer is a California congresswoman. She is the author of the new book, Undaunted, Surviving Jonestown, Summoning Courage, and Fighting Back. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck in the new Congress.
Thank you, Joe.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much. Again, Jackie Speer, author of Undaunted. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.